10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Xin chào.
Live from Qatar, this is The Morning Break with Dorian Brown.
Good morning, another week, another dollar, and it is Friday with the weekend firmly in our sights. I'm Dorian Brown, it's Friday the 24th of September, and we are live on Teachers Talk Radio, where today my guest and I will be discussing how schools are responding to the climate crisis. What is or has your school been doing to the in response to the climate crisis? Text, tweet in, and let us know.
Live from Qatar, this is The Morning Break with Dorian Brown on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live at ttradio.org. Or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning, one and all. I hope you can hear me, and thank you for tuning in this morning on the Friday Morning Break. We have got a few more hours until the weekend can begin in earnest, and I hope that your weekly routine has begun to return to some semblance of normality. In the news this week, before we start, on Tuesday, Susie Dent posted her word of the day, which was throttle bottom, an inept, bumbling, and possibly embarrassing holder of public office. In a completely unrelated news story, our Prime Minister Boris Johnson declared that it was time for us all to grow up and act on climate change, before then wooing the UN by declaring that Kermit the Frog was wrong about being green. Moving on swiftly and smoothly with that lovely transition, today's show is all about a school's particular journey towards taking that action on climate change. And joining me to share his school's journey is Mr. Danny Mayer, who, according to his Twitter bio, is an assistant head, an assistant teacher, and an assistant parent. He says, I think life is trying to tell him something. So, Danny, welcome to Teachers Talk Radio, and thank you for assisting me with the show today.
Thank you, Dorian. I hope I'm not, is it a throttle bottom, did you say?
Throttle bottom, that's the one, yeah. Word of the week.
I hope I'm not one of those, and I won't talk a load of waffle when we're on today.
Me also, but I'm sure you won't. You've got a heck of a lot to say, and we've only, unfortunately, got an hour to actually say it all, Danny. So thank you again for taking your time. I know you're taking your time away from your school to be with us here today, but I hope that the time spent is appreciated, and obviously it shows our support for everything that your school has been doing. So we always start with a little bit of a kind of a what's your name and where'd you come from. So would you care to give us a little bit of a fill-in as to who you are and where you've been and where you are now, please?
Well, I had a bit of a think about this, about what I could say and where I start. And I think I'll probably start just a little bit before I started as a teacher. So this is a Teachers Talk Radio. And I came to teaching a little bit late in life. I suppose, what, it was 28 late in life? And before that, I had a variety of jobs, including sort of chef, cook, bottle washer, and supermarket manager. And I'm not quite sure whether they prepared me for teaching. I hope so.
The whole range of those jobs that we have when we're young to kind of to be able to buy our football stickers on the weekend.
Well, there you go. Well, I was the man providing those football stickers for a long time.
Right.
So I came to teaching a little bit late, and I didn't want teaching. I started as a geography degree, and then kind of fell into sort of GIS and catchment dynamics masters, which wasn't for me. I found a touch boring. But and then I kind of met my wife, who was a teacher, and to her horror, I also wanted to become a teacher. And from then on, the rest is history. And I think we started off our teaching journey in the UK, and then sort of went to China and to Vietnam, where we met Dorian, and. And then back to the sunny climes of England, where the rest is history. And I'm now an assistant head, and an assistant parent, and an assistant lots of things. That tweet handle, whatever it is a little bit of a nod, to all those sort of like those gurus who promote sort of ambitious. And I think sometimes it's all right to be an assistant head.
Oh.
So,
Absolutely. Behind every great head, as they say.
It's a deputy head.
I don't know where I stand on that. Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. It's great to hear that you've kind of got, you know, it's everyone's journey, I think, in education is different. And I think that's why it's so fascinating. It kind of shapes us as to who we are as educators. And I think, you know, that international experience, particularly, you know, for me and a few friends that I've spoken to, really does kind of open eyes to possibilities. And it does somewhat change our perception of really what education should be about, or what in the previous episode we talked about what the purpose of education is. So on your return to the UK then, and now working as an assistant head, could you give us a bit of before we kind of go into the climate crisis, give us a bit of an idea of your role in your current school, how long you've been there, etc., and you know, give us a bit of a behind the curtain of the culture at the school you're at.
Well, I mean, I started there 7 years ago, I think. Work on my maths. And I started as a phase leader, and that was in charge of 5 and 6, and kind of developed from there, really, and took over the assistant head role about four years ago, which has been great. I mean, I'm out of class for 3 days a week, and to my joy, I'm in class for 2 days a week. But a part of that is being a mentor to children, to staff. You know, I love my coaching role. I'm not quite. I have to ask my staff about that though. And I love the everyday workings, machinations of a school and working with people. I very much like to get around the classrooms and get into class and see the children and speak to the teachers. But then, you know, there's the other stuff about developing curriculums and part of what development of curriculum is this climate curriculum, and you get a bit of a handle on it. You get to sort of have your input into the curriculum and sharing that with your teachers, and that's fascinating. I love that. I love developing what our children will learn and then tweaking that and moving that on, you know, looking at what's happening today and what the children need.
And what sticks with me from what you've just said there, which is absolutely fantastic, and I fully believe in it, is that although you are in that capacity of assistant head, you still, did you say 2 days in the classroom still, right? Yeah. And even past those 2 days in the classroom, you're still in and out on a regular basis. Now, I know that's something that I guess as a secondary teacher is something that perhaps maybe we miss so much, you know, in that kind of that revolving door of somebody coming in every now and then, you know, to see how things are going, see how what the children are thinking and this, that and the other. That really attracts me to working in primary, I think, in that regard, because that idea of sometimes as secondary teachers, we can feel a little bit isolated, perhaps, or maybe kind of on our own. And, you know, we're the only adult in the room. We spend the whole day talking to children, which is great. But it's always nice to kind of have that opportunity to kind of reflect on your practice and have someone kind of in and out the classroom, etc., and kind of build, as you said, those conversations about curriculum and interact. Leanne has just texted in as well and said, we feel the same as primary teachers too sometimes. So yeah, perhaps maybe from primary school to primary school, the extent of that kind of in and out of the classroom can vary as well. But it sounds like your school, you're onto a good thing with that, because it does feed into, you know, the reason why you wanted to get into teaching in the first place is to be with and around the children and try to kind of offer them the best educational experience and the best journey in education that you can. And how can you do that unless you're getting that kind of daily contact and feedback from them?
I think you're right. I think with that, I think we really value pupil voice in school, and it's been really hard over the past year or so with the crisis. But throughout that, we've tried to maintain that. We've tried to maintain a pupil voice so that they feel part of the decisions made in school, and part of the climate, the stuff that we're going to talk about. We had a lot of pupil voice in that, and funny enough, one of my favourite days is Monday afternoon or Monday lunchtime when I go over to the year one. I'm head of upper school, and I go over to the year one and two playground and do dig holes in the ground and build fairy camps for the year one, two children. And I think for me, getting to know the children at that level where you can be playing with them and understanding them is a really important side of my job. Is to see that I'm a person as well as an assistant head, and that I'm willing to sort of get in and play, and they can then relate to us as well.
Oh, absolutely. And it builds that familiarity and that relationship, perhaps, when you may be actually teaching them later on in, when they get to upper school as well, which is fantastic. And yes, Leanne says exactly what you've just said, in the way that it is hard to be led by people who don't experience life in the classroom anymore. And I heard someone said not long ago, the idea that, you know, you could have been teaching for 20 years, but if you're not teaching in this year, you can't claim to be a teacher. And so in previous schools that I've worked at, they're, you know, the head teacher and the deputies all have some form of class or relationship within a classroom. And, you know, you need to have that presence in the classroom so that you can kind of temperature check and you got your finger on the pulse of perhaps what is going on a day-to-day basis in classroom. So, yeah, I think that's really valuable and really important. And it's great to hear that you've got that kind of, it sounds like you've got that balance of, you know, the leadership and the engagement with the students as well, because they just dovetail with each other beautifully.
Just a quick note on that. So it's not always like that in schools, you know, and there's reasons why. I mean, each school is independent, you know, and I know we're lucky to have a really brilliant head who's not in class and a really, you know, great deputy, but they rely heavily on us to pass that back to them. And they're really happy for us to make decisions because they know that we know what's going on. You know, I've got another assistant head who we work really closely in because we're in class, but we can then feed back to our, you know, to our head and deputy head to make sure that, you know, decisions are made in conjunction.
Yeah, so having that kind of system, that communication system in place, etc., and that kind of trust, I guess, and that professional trust and autonomy is something which strengthens that kind of dynamic as well. So let's go on and talk about the climate crisis. Then I know I've spoken to you before now about this. Could you give us a quick I guess a history. I know this started before COVID, so maybe if we could start, you know, and let our listeners know really what your thinking was and what your ideas were in terms of trying to address the climate crisis within the school.
It's quite interesting because there's such a huge amount of work going on in school at the moment. I'm sitting here and I've been typing up my notes and putting my notes together, and I'm at my kitchen table, which is a rather large six-seater kitchen table because I've got a big family, and it's covered with notes from what we've done, and that's from everybody who's worked on it. And I'm here as an order, you know, someone to relay this. This is not me. There's a huge amount of people behind this. You know, I stand on the shoulders of giants here. But I just, you know, I'll try to give you some sense of what we're doing and where we are and the pathway. And hopefully I can try and get everybody involved who has been involved in this project, and everybody, you know, who added some work or worked so hard to make this project start. So stop whittering and I'll get to where we are.
Many hands make light work.
I think so. I think you're right there. I think without everybody doing this, we're not going to make this happen. We're not there by a long shot. We're on our own. And we're on a journey. Whether that's the right journey, I hope it is, and we believe it is, and other schools might think differently than us, and that's absolutely fine. I just want to try and I think it's very important to get this message out there of what we think is really important, and hopefully lots of people will agree. So let's go back to kind of why we took this up and why we've moved down this pathway to implement a climate curriculum. So our school has got a real strong sense of community. We have quite a few links with local community. You know, we've worked with our care homes in our areas. We've taken children out into the local environment and worked. We've taken children to our local courts, okay, to understand about stuff like that. So we've got a real sense of community in our school outside. So we're kind of an outward thinking school, you know, so rather than kind of keeping ourselves to ourselves. And we kind of like our children to be abreast of what's happening out in the world. We're quite heavy on the debate side of things within our school, and we've tried to build that in within our curriculum. We were part of the Rouge project for debate, and that's a local project in our area, in the Leeds area, and that worked with the English Schools Council, and that involved us getting part in debate competitions, you know, ending up in the city centre town hall and having that. So there's a lot of inspiration behind where we are. But the main part of what we do is, or what we've done, is kind of a sense of the importance of this. And that's kind of like certainly driven from our top end, from Leslie Mackay, our head teacher, who's taken, kind of put her neck out a lot on this. You know, where we started to really think about this was we discussed things that we could do personally, which was we have solar panels in our school. We've changed our heating system in our school to be a lot more environmentally friendly. We've changed the lighting in the school, looked at recycling. And I know a lot of schools have done that. And that's kind of, we got to that point where it's like, is this enough? Are we doing enough for our children? And we talked to our children about this and said, there's something else. And then the Extinction Rebellion started to happen, and Greta Thunberg came to the forefront of these things. And that's when we started to get really interested in this climate activism and trying to really talk to our children about that. I mean, within the school at that time, we have a science curriculum, which probably, I think if I look at the curriculum from 1 to 6, we might have 5 or 3 or 4 units that are based on climate change. And that will be in our science topic. And we thought to ourselves, that's just not enough. We wanted to give more. I mean, when we talked to the children about this the first time, the thinking wasn't there. The understanding wasn't there. The joined up thinking wasn't there. And that's from year 6 all the way down. And so we kind of weren't happy about that. We weren't happy about them not being able to join up the dots, to understand the bigger picture. So we often started talking about the big picture, but they didn't
and then
understand.
They were lost. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if I can interject there, because I think that's a really valid point that you've made, because we've done a couple of shows in the past about global citizenship and service. And by the sounds of what you're doing there is you're kind of laying the foundations for, you know, experiential learning, kind of like service, building compassion, and kind of building this culture of care, as you said at the start, looking outwards, which means when you are implementing this climate curriculum, like you said, that everyone the buy-in, if you like, or the acceptance of it is a lot more effective. There's a lot more cohesion there because you've got these kind of structures in place where the students already realize that there's this kind of social action which is necessary.
I think you're absolutely right. I think the key is a lot of like schools have school councils, they have environmental councils. And that is great, and that's a pathway to developing what we're doing, but it's still quite linear, one thread that's going through. And without all of that understanding of what is happening to our world, from the scientific background to the impact to the urgency to all of that, then there's not really sort of a good understanding or a good ability for them to go, right, okay, hang on a minute, let me get a handle on this. Where can I add? Where can I make things happen? What can I do? Because I don't understand what's going on.
Is this a good time to sort of ask as well? Oh, hi to Michael from Slovakia, who's just tuned in as well. Thank you for listening. If you've got any experiences yourself of the climate crisis or what you do in your school, then do feel free to call or text in. But I was just wondering, Danny, if it's a good time to ask here, or maybe it might be a little bit later, about, you know, you're building up this sense of engagement from the students. But what about staff? Where are your staff in all this? Is there kind of like a collegiality and a mutual kind of understanding and agreement that this is where the direction and where you would like to go in embedding this curriculum, or did you have to encourage some people to get on board?
I think we do have a very concerned staff body who want to take action, and I think before the COVID outbreak, I think, you know, we had a very a clear plan. We were moving forward and we were ready. Okay. Mm. As we've come back, we've had to readjust that to make sure that everybody's on board. And I think people understand that, hey, you know, this is really important. Okay. This is probably the most important thing we'll ever deliver to our students in our lifetime. I mean, if we hark back to the 1980s when we started talking about health within the curriculum. And the 1990s, where we started to talk about alcohol and cigarettes, and we started to deliver that to students. And we can now start to see the benefits of that in our students' health. I mean, not amazingly so, but there are, you know, there are figures to say that drinking is down and smoking is vastly reduced. So there is a time when we need to go, okay, here, and this is important. And I think our staff think that it's how it's done is really important that we get right with our staff and with our senior leaderships in school.
Yes, I like that. And some good question which kind of popped into my head just then, which is probably a whole show in itself, which I think I'm just going to drop the question and then we'll move on to the next part of what you're of the story, is that idea of, you know, yes, climate crisis is urgent, we need to act now, but also, you know, following COVID, you know, the buzz of well-being and making sure that everybody individually is all right is also a priority. And so there's not really a question there, but a kind of like, well, many people are, we can't worry about the climate right now because you've got to worry about ourselves first. You know, we've got to put our masks on first. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and I understand. I mean, there's a thousand things out there that we could all worry about first, isn't there? I mean, you know, we've got Brexit. I mean, that affected us with, you know, certainly thinking about our Erasmus project, which I'll get into later. But there's all these things. You're right. And over the last year, the key issue has been COVID and looking after ourselves and looking after our staff well-being and ensuring we're delivering a curriculum of sorts to our children, whether it had been online or whether it had been in school. But throughout that, we've kept going with the climate as much as possible, and that is ensuring that we've got staff ticking over with our projects, ticking over with resources. You know, we understand that we couldn't throw all of it at us like, as if we're going to do now. But even now, you still have the tendrils of COVID drifting through school. You know, we're having staff, you know, off with COVID as, you know, today and yesterday. And that means that we're still down. But what we're asking our staff to do now is we're up to that level where we've got it into our long-term plans. We're starting to get resources together. And we're just starting to ask our teachers to say, hey, look at what we've done so far in our curriculum. And can we, you know, manipulate it and move these climate learning outcomes into our curriculum? And the staff have been brilliant that, you know, they're stepping up. We're at the start of our journey again now. And if you ask me that in about 6 months' time, how do our staff feel? I might be able to give you a really good answer then.
Pencils in show for 6 months' time. Yeah, fantastic. I mean, it sounds like you know, very a lot of work has already gone in already, and obviously COVID was a minor speed bump in the progression of being able to get this curriculum in.
Interesting in place. The way to describe COVID.
Yes, a speed bump, a distraction. But again, it is in the way that, you know, it is a bigger issue. You know, if the climate crisis continues without any action, etc., then it doesn't matter what COVID at all. You know, we're not, you know, sea levels are rising, forest fires are on the rise, severity and frequency of tropical storms, etc., all of that stuff, you know, should be the priority on top of many other things that we've got pecking away at us. So absolutely fascinating so far, and I would like to kind of open up a couple of questions to you in a second as well regarding, you know, when you're looking at the curriculum, is that looking at a particular year level, or is it particular subjects within every year level, etc.? So we'll get you to kind of to flush that out a little bit with us in a second, but we're just going to go to a quick news break before we come back in a couple of minutes.
Okay,
need support with your phonics.
Thank you.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This is your latest Teachers Talk Radio News with Gail Glenn.
According to a report in the Guardian newspaper, black and minority ethnic girls in England are more than twice as likely to be excluded from school as their white counterparts. Agenda, an alliance of more than 50 charities campaigning for the most excluded women and girls, uncovered data following a Freedom of Information request to the Department of Education. This data showed that during the autumn term in both 2018 and 2019, Black Caribbean girls were permanently excluded from school at double the rate of white British girls. Gypsy, Roma and traveller communities were four times more likely to face permanent exclusion than white British girls. A Department for Education spokesperson said, "We back head teachers to suspend or permanently exclude pupils where this helps maintain calm classrooms that bring out the best in every child. But this should only be used as a last resort. We expect staff to consider any underlying cause of poor behaviour before making this decision. We know children and young people from some backgrounds are more likely to be excluded. That is why we are working to deliver significantly improved outcomes for children and young people in alternative provision, who are most at risk of permanent exclusion." The Department for Education has announced the expansion of its Glasses in Classes scheme. It aims to provide two pairs of glasses, one for home and one for school, to more than 9,000 students in at least 225 schools in England. The scheme was piloted in Bradford and will now include Doncaster, Derby, Durham, Norwich and Breckland and the North Yorkshire coast. Students will also receive support from a vision coordinator under the scheme to ensure follow-up eye examinations are attended and glasses are worn regularly. Jeff Barton, General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, said, "This novel scheme focuses on young people whose learning is hampered by poor eyesight and whose circumstances mean they have either not been to see an optician or do not have the glasses they need. It is refreshing to see the government reacting positively to a local initiative that has seen results in Bradford and extending it to a further five disadvantaged areas in the north of the country." This has been your daily education news briefing.
Thank you for that, Gail, and you are joining us on Teachers Talk Radio. This is the Friday morning break. Do feel free to call or text or tweet in the show if you have anything to contribute or any questions for my guest today, who is Mr. Danny Maher. And he is talking about the journey in which he and his school and his colleagues have been on in terms of implementing the curriculum for the climate crisis. Now, just before the break there, Danny did mention that the catalyst for the curriculum to be implemented was in fact the climate action, the youth strikes, and Greta Thunberg. So I think from what you're saying, Danny, is that you went from kind of piecemeal actions, sort of small little, I don't want to say tokenistic, but small kind of acts and events, you know, which are kind of one-off, and then the idea after the youth strikes was to kind of make that more as part of an embedded curriculum, if I'm right.
Yeah, absolutely. Leslie, our head teacher, she wanted to do something to sort of show that the school was behind the climate crisis, and we were delivering it to our children, and we wanted to take part in that. The first strike was in the November 2019 strike was where we wanted to head towards. But before that, we wanted to give the children a little bit of understanding what was going on. So Leslie produced a number of assemblies where we talked about Greta Thunberg and we talked about Extinction Rebellion and climate strike to give the children a little bit of an understanding. Then we decided that we wanted to be part of the strike. Now, we didn't think, obviously, we could take 500 students down to the strike, which would be a little bit challenging. I've taken some field trips in my time, but that would be incredible. Yeah,
so I'm just thinking logistics, buses and lunches.
Assessment. But no, so what we decided to do, we wanted to strike against the national curriculum to say, okay, we're off national curriculum today, and what we're going to do, we're not going to give up on education. We're going to learn about certain areas of the climate and how it's been affected. So each year group will take on an area. It might be flooding in year three, which was linked to children's topic on rivers. So we did that in a morning, and we rolled that out, and children produced things based on that. And then in the afternoon we had a rally. So the rally was linked to what the children were doing, and produced banners. And then we walked around the table, the playground. around the playground as if we were part of that rally. And that got a lot of children really interested, and a lot of teachers were stepping up to that. But we kind of thought, where next? Where can we go next with this? And we continued with this kind of one-off event when we went to the Valentine's Day strike in February 2020. Now, that was a step up for us. Leslie decided that we wanted to attend that, and we took 8 Year 6 children down there. And we took governors, we took parents, we tried to get the buy-in from the whole community as part of this. And then the children who were left in school, we carried on with doing some activities based on the climate crisis. Our children then delivered speeches in front of the crowds down there. And this was in sort of conjunction with the youth strike. And we had sixth formers come into school to talk to our children. And they're incredibly inspirational. You know, you can see our year six children eyes opening and looking at these older children talking and being really passionate about the subject. And we took 8 amazing children down to that event. And, you know, there was newspapers and media down there. And they all stood up in front of a huge crowd, which was an amazing thing for them to do, and delivered incredible speeches, which they'd written themselves, and really passionate speeches.
Preparation with the debating, working with Aruj and stuff, kind of really did kind of condition them for that. But I guess speaking in front of that many people would have, you know, wow, what an achievement, and what a message almost as well.
Absolutely. I mean, we were really lucky. Greta retweeted one of our children's speeches as well. So
wow.
That caused a lot of excitement in school. And at that time, it was a really great experience to be in school. You know, lots of excitement around it. You know, there was talk of media coming in, and then boom, with the COVID event happened. So that kind of then dampened things down for a long while. And
took the wind out of the sails, as it were.
It did. But before... As this stuff was happening, we were starting to create links with the Development Education Centre in Leeds, who are an amazing charity who develop educational resources for lots of different areas. And part of that is they've started to take on the climate curriculum. And there's some brilliant people who work for them, and they do a brilliant job. And the learning outcomes they've created have been, you know, for us, you know, absolutely groundbreaking, and it's where we can start and move on into the curriculum.
Is that, just to interject again, is that a state organisation or a DEC? Is that a government organisation?
I think it's a both. I think it's, I think there's a bit of, well, certainly from, I think it's a charity organisation. I think it's a collaboration of people working together, schools and different groups working together to produce these resources.
Right. Okay, and how does that so post COVID then? So you said that there was sort of during COVID you were trying to kind of keep the plate spinning, as it were. Mm-hmm. You know, but obviously taking into account that, you know, all of the online learning and everything and well-being, etc., obviously took precedent over that. So coming back post-COVID, or sort of, can you let us know how that has looked, or how it is looking this year, where you're at now?
So so if we just rewind a little bit, so there we go, we're at the right.
There we go, we're there, yeah.
So I met with Sarah Fishwick from the DEC, and we took their learning outcomes. So I'll just give you a little bit of an understanding, an overview. I mean, it's quite an in-depth curriculum. So that it has key ideas, and then within those key ideas, you have progressive learning outcomes. So, for example, we've got one key idea is scientific background. And that's, so for example, by the end of year two, one of the learning outcomes is pupils understand the distinction between weather and climate. And then you can fast forward to year six, and pupils can name key carbon sinks such as forest, peatlands, ocean, algal blooms, healthy soil. So, and then that goes all the way up to year 11, where students can name a range of greenhouse gases, describe in detail processes that lead to the increased cross-shaking atmosphere. So it's a progressive curriculum. If you can see, if children don't understand the distinction between weather and climate, they're going to struggle to understand, you know, some of the key objectives that we're trying to talk to them later on in the school.
And that marries up very well with the idea of this, you know, using curriculum as a progression model, isn't it? Building on what has gone on years before. And if you can kind of interweave a subject like, you know, the climate crisis throughout multiple year groups, as, you know, building on skills as you go, I mean, that's a good model for, you know, anything else in a particular subject as well.
I mean, I don't know about high secondary school. I can't really comment on that because I don't know it. But certainly for us, if it's not in the curriculum, then it often doesn't get done. So for us, we have, if we want something to really be successful, we put it into the curriculum. And at the moment, we've got climate that we're sliding into our curriculum. We're also looking at the equality areas that are, again, being put into our curriculum. And the climate is quite an in-depth study that we're trying to do, you know, and same with the quality. But without that actually in your everyday curriculum, then it just won't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's normally the thing, the extracurricular stuff are the things that tend to be the first to go if there's a kind of a squeeze on time or anything like that. So making sure that it is articulated and mandatory that these things are kind of covered in your curriculum, yeah, is the surefire way of actually making sure they get done. And also at the same time, we again, in the previous episode when we talked about service learning, you know, in many schools, those things are the extra, the add-ons, et cetera, that we use to kind of build compassion and care and shape positive dispositions. But again, those things, because they are extra, are at threat sometimes from actually not being covered because of the depth required perhaps in the curriculum. So making sure that the climate crisis and all of the knowledge and understanding surrounding that is part of the curriculum, it has to be the step that a school takes to ensure that every child actually gets exposed to those educational experiences.
Yeah, and I think when I sat down with Sarah and I looked at, because this is, so just to give you an overview, if you imagine scientific background has three or four learning outcomes per phase, really. So by the end of year two, we have, by the end of year four, we have to have these, by the end of year six, year nine, and year 11. And I think I looked at that and we have key ideas, pace, scientific background, key ideas, urgency of need for climate action, key ideas, impacts of climate change, key ideas, response to climate change, key ideas, consumption and climate justice, key ideas, possible futures, key ideas, mindsets and viewpoints. And exactly.
This is primary age students as well. This is fantastic that's in there.
Feel that. Yeah, I was like, wow, how am I ever going to get that into a curriculum? But talking with Sarah at the DC, you're not just, because a lot of people think science, geography. But it's not. It's not just about that. We've got our. I've got my long-term plan in front of me, and I've got. These key learning outcomes. I've got them in PHSE, Identity, Social, and Equality for Democracy. I have those learning outcomes in there. So we are slipping and putting these learning outcomes across our curriculum, and that's from science.
Cool.
To history, to art, to RE, to you know, so that, you know, we're thinking in every area that the children are impacted by the climate crisis.
And I think, yeah, wow, what a task that is to be able to kind of weave that in, not just through the curriculum, but through each of the individual subjects, and for there to be that kind of that synergy, I guess, between it all. And when you said that, it kind of really made me think about how challenging, even more challenging, that would be in secondary. Not only do we have the curriculum, but, you know, I'm sure many of our listeners, if they're secondary teachers as well, have kind of been given an order or a mandate before that, you know, we need to do more cross-curricular work with lots of different departments. And, you know, you're forcibly sat around a table with a member of each different department and trying to have to get the same concept within each thing and time it right throughout the year. And it's just, you know, more often than not, these things, whilst perhaps maybe good, well-intentioned, don't ever really come to fruition because of the pressures of the curriculum and the fact that actually you're trying to crowbar and link things which just don't necessarily, you know, that doesn't really work. But I can see from maybe a primary perspective, you know, these things are into, you know, they're more interchangeable. Would you say that you can?
I think we do
got more of an overview.
Well, we do have, you know, we have coordinators that run all these different subjects and everybody, you know, and same in high school, everybody's clamoring to get their subject to the forefront and everybody's ensuring that they have all of the learning outcomes within their subjects. And I know high school RE and geography and all the other subjects are you know, you have GCSEs and A levels at the end of them, so you have a really important curriculum to cover. However, it's will, isn't it? It's important to have the will to implement something as important to our children's understanding, because in certain areas like science, you can't get across the importance of how children are feeling about you know, seeing all this stuff in the media, you know, being bombarded by wildfires, by bombarded by floods. And, you know, we haven't even touched the surface when we talk to children about how they're feeling, because children, you know, they see these and high school children will see these and, you know, the impact of fashion, the impact of technology on the climate. You know, with one of our PHSCE, our objective is in year four is pupils can talk about their feelings about the earth and natural world, our changing climate and its impacts, and to know that others have a range of different feelings, including anxiety and fear. I mean, how is that going to be slipped into a science lesson? I mean, that's got to be talked about in conjunction with sort of, you know, your social and health, and that's part of our physical and health wing. And it's really important for the children to understand, oh, this is in our health and well-being lessons. So this is about me. This is about my understanding, not this is the science. And oh, by the way, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, okay. And that anxiety and fear comes from media, doesn't it? And yeah, I don't think we don't actually question or ask the question as to how students feel as a result of being exposed to all of this. I don't want to say doom and gloom, but I mean, it does seem that, you know, on a daily or weekly basis, there is something linked to the climate crisis, which is, you know, not necessarily on the front door, but it's getting closer and closer, and it must feel that to the students, they must feeling quite anxious, particularly because they also feel, and this is perhaps maybe where we can kind of weave this back into what you're doing at your school, they feel that they have got no say, or they've got no control over the earth which they've been has been bequeathed to them.
And the key is in with the language is it's not for you, it's for the next generation. And then the next generation looking at you going, well, what do I do about it? How do I feel about it? I feel, well, you're putting it on my shoulders, but you're not really giving me the tools to deal with it. And I think that's an important way. And that's one of the key objectives, again, for our science, for our PHSE, is saying to children, actually, you know, we can take action on this. You can take action on this. And it's not, you know, this isn't the future you can have. There is, you know, alternative futures. And then you can reimagine different futures. And one of our, I mean, we had a bit of a taster. We designed a DT and coding unit in year three, where children, we learned about technology through time, and then we learned about robotics and technology, and then the children reimagined how to create a piece of technology that would lower energy use. And, you know, children come up with all sorts of great things, and that's an interesting way. And we talked about that you can, our world can be different, and we looked and analyzed all the different technologies out there that can change our world, and that then helps them to understand, actually, I can be an engineer and I can create a a poo-o-matic that collects poo and then delivers energy from it. You know, that was one of our machines.
I want one.
So, you know, but that's an important understanding from the age of seven, is that I can make a difference. There is a whole world out there that's not going right at the moment, but I can make a difference. So it's all right.
Fantastic. Absolutely fascinating. And agree as well. And the earlier and the sooner that they can see that their actions, their compassion and their care for things, they can do something about it. I think the sooner that kind of anxiety and that fear of the future perhaps maybe might not subside completely, but kind of be eased somewhat. Danny, we're kind of hurtling towards the hour. So I'm really keen to kind of be able to give our listeners some kind of grains of ideas, really, about sort of coming away from this conversation and little things that they can perhaps maybe start to do to get the ball rolling or kind of enhance what they've already got. So what we'll do is we'll have a quick ad break.
Okay.
And then when we come back, we can kind of see what you've got in motion at the moment, and maybe people can have some ideas about what they can do at their school. So we'll be back in 2 minutes. Thank you, Dan.
No worries. Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE-validated programmes to help you? Read-Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Do you struggle with people pleasing? Is it a constant battle managing different and difficult personalities? Why not inspire, challenge, and empower your team through the MAL CPD Essential Coaching Skills for School Leaders course? Or gain practical skills to become a strong and compassionate leader through the Assertive Leadership and the Emotionally Intelligent Leader courses. All MAL CPD courses are accredited by the Institute of Leadership and Management. Find out more at www.malcpd.com. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. teacherslovestationery.club.
Welcome back, Teachers Talk Radio. We are live. This is the Friday morning break, and we've just got about 10, 15 minutes left to go of this morning's show, where we are talking about a curriculum for the climate crisis. And my guest, Danny Mayer, has been talking to us about his school's journey, and it has been long and varied, and there's been a few speed bumps in the road. But the section which we just talked about, I thought was really revealing in the way that it shows how important it is to make to mandate almost, or to kind of weave things into our curriculum that will allow students to think, that will allow them to have the knowledge and the understanding of our existence and the changes that they can actively make even at a young age. Just before we kind of push on, I'll just share. We had a couple of tweets regarding this earlier on, and I sort of asked, you know, what other schools, etc., were doing in regards to climate crisis. So just to give us a bit of a yardstick as to where other schools are, George has sort of tweeted in and said that the school isn't doing much, and me and a bunch of staff who care are through our everyday teaching and ranting regularly at chappy teenagers wanting a new phone. So I guess those kind of teaspoons of change, those kind of that bottom up organic approach from individual teachers is a way of being able to kind of address this. But, you know, we have to, I think, as Danny's kind of laid out to us in some ways, it does have to come from the top and the bottom almost. It has to be kind of like a dual kind of multimodal approach to kind of push these things through. Lucy messaged in as well and said that the new overlords for my establishment are apparently quite big on sustainability, but remains to be seen. So, you know, I really think, you know, there is a sliding scale almost of where schools are at currently with this. And I wonder if I just kind of start talking with you, Danny, about this and thinking about, is it the fact that you have created the culture within your school, you've created the buy-in from teachers and from parents and from governors, et cetera, to say, look, do you know what? This is so important that we really need to take action now and do something about it. Is that how you've kind of gotten to where you are right now?
I think so. I mean, I think it has to be led by somebody with real passion, and then trying to get that passion across in a way that is manageable. I think that's a really key thing. I mean, we've had Leslie's so passionate about that, our head teacher, and I think I'm quite passionate about it as well, and I think our senior leadership team, as a group of people, have bought into all of that, and we could see potentially where the issues were in the climate and where we wanted to go with that. And then you kind of have to deliver it to the staff. I mean, nobody wants more workload. And I think that's the key with anything that you put in. Nobody wants more workload. And you have to try to manipulate what you do so that your teachers are able to do it within a given time. So lots of what we did, we asked, and the same when we started to deliver our curriculum, we tried to do that within our staff meetings. We tried to do that certain with our coordinators. We now have two climate change coordinators in school, and they are given time out of class to meet up with the Erasmus project, which we'll talk about in a minute. You know, and we try to give the teachers and the staff time to put this into practice. And we just had a recent twilight, a bit of a review twilight of how everything's gone on. But that's within, we're not saying to anybody, right, okay, we want you to stay in late in school and we make sure because it's important. We're saying it is important, but we don't want you to do loads of planning outside school. The hard thing is where we are now. And this is the bit now where we are reaching up to the top of the tree to take the fruit. It's really out there. There's not much out there resource-wise for these lessons. I can't comment on high school, but I think probably in high school you've got a lot more, you know, of the scientific background within your sciences and within your geography that you can sort of, you know, you can re-engage with the students as a climate crisis, as a climate lesson. Whereas in primary, this is new. This is new. We have had the science stuff there, but all of, you know, like I talked about before, where you're talking about how children are feeling and how they have a sense of purpose, and talking about climate justice. I mean, that's a really important thing that children need to understand, that, hey, hang on a minute, you know, the Europe and lots of North America have used up all these fossil fuels, and how fair is that, you know?
And I think actually, just to kind of build on what you've just said there, is that yes, perhaps maybe in secondary school there is the kind of an opportunity to build on things, but actually if you wind that back and say, actually, well, if we're talking about climate justice and stewardship, resource stewardship, etc., in primary, then that enables secondary to go even, you know, even deeper and think even more critically and take even sort of bigger steps as well. And it seems to be remiss of us to not have such a well articulated climate curriculum in primary to lay those kind of building blocks, if you like, in which to build upon. And so this should be coming from the government, right? A government priority, government priorities. And I love what you said about the idea. It feels like every show I talk about, the time word comes in quite often. And the danger of having passionate people involved in things is that, oh, you're passionate about it, you spend more time doing X, Y, and Z. So those people that do see an importance and have a real interest in kind of making, tangible change, etc., are the ones that end up having to do the graft, isn't it, to get things over the line or get things started. Whereas really, as a school, and it sounds like your school is, by offering Twilight Inset, actually giving time to do these things is vital for their success and sustainability.
Yeah, that's been a really important, and we know that these are going to be hard. I've developed three lessons based on the learning outcomes, and they've been very difficult to get together. And I think we are pioneers, certainly in primary school, of this. I mean, I'm sure there's other schools around that are doing it, and if there are, I'd like to hear from them. If they've got any lesson plans to share with us, fantastic.
Absolutely, yeah,
that would be brilliant, and to share. And that sort of bleeds me nicely into this Erasmus project that's happening. And this we've got on board with this before COVID, and it's about this issue of delivering lessons, delivering resources. And we now work with teachers in Turkey, teachers in Ireland, and teachers in Germany, and ourselves, who are the English counterparts. Now I'm not completely part of this Erasmus project. We are two coordinators, Henry and Rachel. They're heavily into this now, and they've established a working party as part of this, and they regularly meet on Zoom, which has been fantastic, really, to have this brought about by COVID, and some things unfortunately do well out of bad things. So we can now meet quite on a regular basis, once a term, once every half term. And we're starting to develop toolkits for other schools and other teachers to dip into and say, actually, oh, that's a brilliant, I love that DT idea, or I love that, and that fits there. And then maybe that will encourage them to take the climate curriculum and go, do you know what, everything's there. And this stuff's amazing. Yes. Let's grab this and run it in our school. Because this is more than just us doing this for our school, and it is, and it's important that we're doing it for our school. But what's really important is that in Turkey, in Ireland, in Germany, in England, and in maybe hopefully in France and in other stuff, we all start to engage in this, and we all start to share resources, and we all start to move forward, with this, and engage in dialogue with other countries and talk about how they're doing it and talk about how they're educating their next generation.
Yeah, fantastic. And I think that it's so important from what you've said there about the, sharing good practice and stuff. We don't want every school kind of like reinventing the wheel, etc. Because the concepts and the ideas and the science are the same whether you're in Blackpool or Bradford or wherever. It doesn't matter. It's macro, and this is why perhaps maybe there might be some frustration in the way that there isn't this directive, there isn't this kind of like this bigger umbrella kind of everyone needs. Here's the resources that we've developed. I know, for example, from what you said there, I was thinking something similar to Oak National, during kind of lockdown, a kind of a plug and play, if you like, a toolkit. Absolutely. And a kind of a thing that everybody can engage with. And also what that does is it ensures that everybody is also getting the same message as well. And debate and discussion can kind of follow from everyone having kind of gotten up to the same part or same level of that.
And it's about creating dialogue. We're not saying that we're creating the right. We're trying to develop something and develop resources that might fit. I mean, for example, we'd look at history and we look at how the ancients thought and used the environment in history. Wow, where do you start with that? I mean, I looked at Rome to begin with. I thought, okay, let's look at Rome. And luckily, they've got, Rome and Greece. We've got Plato, and we've got some of the Roman orators, and we can take that as a secondary resource. And there's lots of that dominance over the environment. So children could look at that and go, actually, this is not a new thing. This is not a new thing that people abuse the environment and dominated the environment. So this has been happening for a long time. So, but that was really difficult to create a lesson on that. But now that's a model, and someone could take that and go, actually, change that, change that. But we're not starting at ground zero.
Right. Absolutely. And fascinating. And I'm really kind of keen to hear about how your journey kind of continues over the next, like you said, 6 months, Danny, because it feels like that you've laid some foundations. It's taken time. You've had some challenges, and yet you're still kind of seem to be on the on a path, if you like, to make sure that you are enriching the curriculum, and it's going to have you know, a positive impact on the climate crisis. A couple of things. I don't know if you've we're nearing the end where we're going to have to kind of call it a day. I wanted to just kind of just put a quick plug there for the climate, nature, and how to make a difference lesson. I've seen it kind of circulating. Eventbrite have kind of circulated it, and it's from an organization called Aim High.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, and what they've got is, I think it's on the on the 20th of September or something like that. It's basically a huge global lesson. So you've got a whole day of four different lessons, etc., which people can kind of engage with. And yes, it is one, kind of, it seems to be kind of like a one day event or a couple of day event, but it's a starting point for people. I think it might be something to really kind of look into if you're kind of an eco coordinator or even a class leader, at looking at some sort of event which can kind of really spark a conversation and kind of get things moving. Do you have any other kind of sort of tips in the next kind of minute you can drop us, where, you know, if people are looking to start their journey with this, that could help?
I think it's just having the will to do it. It's to say, okay, right. And but it's, as I said before, it's about not burdening your staff with just lots of stuff. It's about taking that journey and hey, we all know this is important. We all know we're in a bit of a hurry here, you know, but it's about putting it in properly. It's about working with the DEC, linking with other schools, you know, and if anybody wants to contact me, they're more than welcome to contact me to find out more about this. And I'm sure if they contact Sarah or Adam at DEC, they'll be more than happy to share the resources we've got. I mean, we are in development, okay, but we're heading in the right direction. But plan it in, take it step by step, and share.
Beautiful. And all of that contact details and the links and stuff we will put in today's show notes. It's a real shame that I've got to kind of bring it to an end now, unfortunately. I've enjoyed every single second. Your enthusiasm, Danny, has come across, and I'm just so impressed that you have got this kind of this drive to really make a difference. And it is something which is really kind of, you know, I hope everyone listening can really take something away today and action it in their school. So I'd like to thank you very much for coming on the show, Danny. It's been really enjoyable. And I may hold you to that 6 month check-in as well, and perhaps you can come back on the show and let us know how things are going in your school.
It'd be an absolute pleasure. So can I just say that I stand on the shoulders of giants? This is me just feeding this out. There's a lot of people who are way more important than me and way more work far harder on this than I did.
Absolutely, of course, and for, to get anything done in any institution or any place, that's exactly what it is. Those people behind the scenes that really do make things happen. So thank you so much once again, Danny. Absolutely amazing. And I'll let you get back to your teaching.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dorian.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.